There's a term we like to use called essentially being the integration bitch. It was the case in which we needed to integrate into a new exchange. It's pretty cool when it comes to integrating into these different DeFi venues, these centralized exchanges. Aside from centralized exchanges, these different DeFi venues on chain, it's pretty cool being able to see their systems and how they work and being able to potentially find opportunities in that.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors: MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name is Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with OX Taker. How's it going?
GM, GM, sir. How you doing? I'm doing well.
Not too bad, not too bad. Coming to see you in London, take you down. Still with your MEV, so IRL MEV.
Backrun all the stuff happening in London.
I'm going to backrun you when you least expect it. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, let's see. So I guess we can delve generally into it. I have a sort of background in MEV searching. I think most people know me for essentially nerd sniping a lot of different information in the MEV searching space. But my background also goes way into essentially a lot of trading in TF2 as well as CSGO back in the days. So almost a decade now. Used to be like a TF2 as well as like CSGO skin trader. So this was on a different online community back when NFTs on the blockchain, but pretty much on the centralized system. There would be these like different video game assets that you could essentially trade for these different games. It would be always interesting just to be able to, of course, trade them to other people. The system at the time was very, very primitive. Yeah, essentially, it would be the case in which you'd be able to do certain things, such as, let's say, make trade offers with your friends, even be able to sell these items for cash through either the official marketplace, or you could either, you know, of course, sell them with this sort of peer-to-peer system that you had, sell them to other people for cash via PayPal and Skrill. And so pretty much I made, I'd say, a killing off that essentially. Soon enough then, yeah, essentially decided, hey, you know, a lot of people are starting to now, you know, sort of make these bots that essentially automate this trading. Started like delve more into programming, in fact, through that. So that's how I actually got a lot more into, yeah, essentially programming, as well as just learning a bunch of things in order to essentially automate the sort of trading that I was doing. This would be either things such as what you'd call now like almost basis trades for either trying to find different arbitrages between different items that people are selling.
Skin MEV.
Exactly. And being able to, you know, just spot out stuff where, you know, people literally would just pay, you know, tens of hundreds of dollars for these skins, whereas someone else's expected value for the skin might be something different. And yeah. So it's like sort of arbitrage that it was always quite nice. I soon enough then started looking into, in fact, making an exchange. And so, yeah, worked with a couple of buddies on this. And yeah, we soon launched it. This was for trading CSGO skins for cash, in fact, since trading peer-to-peer with different people online that you know for these items that can go for tens of hundreds of dollars and sort of expecting them, you know, to wire you the cash afterwards. Or even an example is PayPal allows you to, in fact, charge back.
Oh, the chargebacks. The PTSD.
Oh god, yeah, those were just, it was so hectic when essentially you would see those sort of situations pop up. And so, you know, we wanted to, of course, make a much more fairer marketplace where people had a lot more certainty when it came to trading things, especially when it came to trading these skins for cash. And so, yeah, pretty much we were one of the first exchanges to do that and got pretty popular. Of course, you know, nowadays compared to the volumes in CSGO, pretty much almost nothing. But at the time, it was pretty much a case in which we were one of the top exchanges. And soon enough, it was the case in which we got a buyout offer, took my exit, which was in Bitcoin, in fact. And that's how I eventually got into crypto.
And that was in 2014, 15.
Yeah, 2014, 15 at the time. Crazy stuff back then. And that a lot of what DeFi is now does not compare to what was happening at the time and back in 2014 and 15. But I think during then, I was like, I remember that this like sort of move to trying out cryptocurrencies and whatnot. I remember just trying out, jumping onto the hype of course, you know, jumping onto these like very, very early alt layer ones such as Litecoin and Doge.
Oh, man. What did you do with the Bitcoin? Because that was like before everything popped off.
Yeah, that was, at the time I was getting more financially, I guess, wise, really, when it came to just trying to up my financial literacy. I saved like a portion of it in just essentially code reserves, a portion of it essentially cashed out. So I managed to get some help with that, essentially, in terms of making it official. And then the rest of it, I actually moved on to just like messing about with these different projects that were in the crypto ecosystem at the time. So I think these ones were, you have these sort of games like CryptoKitties, in fact.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Super old. Oh, geez.
Yes. And it's like they had this sort of system where, of course, like, you know, you could breed two kitties and be able to potentially generate one with a very, very rare trait and whatnot.
Man, I wish I was around those times. That would have been so fun.
Yeah, those were like some of the earliest times. And yeah, and it was really, really interesting to look back and just see how it compares to nowadays and whatnot. So yeah, eventually like was doing all manual trading along the side as I was going through some of my studies. And this was also the time when I was starting work at different Web2 startups. This was the time when I guess they were growing. There was a lot of speak about the term fintech started coming about, open banking. And so, you know, there's like sort of narratives of the past decade pretty much was working at a couple of different startups of those, interning at a couple of those, understanding that sort of game to it, how these different companies ran, you know, a very, very small size, maybe like smallest team at startup that I joined was about, I think, 3-4 people. And so it was very lean when it came to seeing, you know, the sort of contributions that you needed to make in order to make sure that, for one, the startup could stay afloat, you know, this sort of ship that is sinking with operating costs and whatnot, making sure that you essentially were able to keep the ship afloat as long as you were aligned with the sort of mission that they wanted to fulfill. Soon afterwards, then, like, did my sort of time there, it was soon starting to get back into more DeFi cryptocurrencies at the time, since that was starting to grow as well. I remember like the first instances of Kyber Network. There were a bunch of these different startups that were making such a large presence, in fact.
You know, Kyber's interesting. They've been around for so long and they've gone through so many hardships with all the hacks and shit, but they're still alive. It's remarkable. Usually people just die out within one hack. And then it's just done. The reputation's over. I have to restart. But they've persevered.
Yeah, I guess Kyber is really a really good example of the sort of grit that you need to be able to last that long.
They're like immune turmoil. It's just perma-rugged, but still keep going. They've got to make it, bro. They've just gone through so much.
Yeah, another one is Shapeshift. So yeah, I was using that a lot back in the days. And, you know, it's still around. Like Eric Voorhees' project from back in the days. It's just amazing just to see that it's around. Yeah, I started getting more into DeFi. Then I was on my same sort of routine of sort of like, you know, trying to understand macro as well as microstructure of DeFi, which was very, very primitive at the time. Aave coming around, there was like a Ether Delta quite early on. And there were like a lot of interesting techniques that you could do essentially when it came to being able to do these different yield opportunities, whether that be, you know, holding some sort of token, especially when it came to, let's say, ICOs or, you know, how your sort of strategy towards those. And so as I started getting back into it, it was more about being able to like see what sort of opportunities came from specifically a lot of these ICOs that were happening.
Was this before DeFi Summer?
I guess I'm not sure like which DeFi Summer you might be referencing, but yeah, there was definitely...
He's a war veteran. Too many DeFi Summers.
There's been like a lot of different, of course, cycles that have happened. And I think the ICO boom, it was a pretty interesting one to go through. I think that was when it really, really made...
Some noise.
Yeah, I think for one, a lot of millionaires, but also a lot of people started looking more into, I think, smart contracts, in fact. So a lot of people were starting to look into how to exactly engineer these different ICOs. How would you essentially like sell them and whatnot, as well as the auction theory behind them and essentially looking into the protocols that you would eventually build. And so it was very, very interesting delving more into that soon enough. Mm-hmm. I understand that essentially doing these different yield opportunities off that before soon enough starting to get more into what we sort of now call, I guess, MEV. So doing these liquidations and sort of seeing, you know, what sort of arbitrage opportunities are there to be able to capture, even if it's manual.
Were there any war stories from the olden days of MEV that you saw back in your day?
Let's see. Yeah, no, I think there's like quite a lot, in fact.
It would have just been like long tail central, like everything was just long tail.
Yeah, it was like pretty much long tail central. Like, I don't think that there were many people that really, you know, many like firms or big groups that had a presence or whatnot. And it's like very, very interesting just to see that pretty much you could just do these sort of manual liquidations and then, you know, come back the next day.
Click a button, instant 10K.
And then come back and, you know, pretty much it was like a fun chore, and it was like, you know, just come back next morning and see what positions I could be liquidating.
How much money can I get from clicking today?
Yeah, no, I think a lot of it was just about learning how all these different protocols work. So more PvE as opposed to PvP at the time, really. And then soon enough, it was the case in which I pretty much did that on the side alongside my studies before soon enough working at a few other like tech companies, both in the Web2 space, and then afterwards then start to delve more into the Web3 space. Soon enough was getting more into MEV. In fact, a couple of different mates of mine from university, and then soon working and essentially joining a couple of teams that were trying to automate this very early on.
The MEV stuff?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Pretty well in terms of comparing it, of course, to the risk-free yield that you could get when it came to, of course, like taking it out into fiat and then after depositing it into some, let's say, some sort of savings account or investments account where you're stocks and shares. Now, it was definitely the case in which there were a lot of lucrative opportunities there. And so it was quite nice that we could get above and above average return off that. Yeah, whilst they're doing minimal work, essentially.
Oh my God. Did you ever build like auto yield adjustment bots?
At the time, it was very, very primitive for us, but we started delving more towards that. In fact, stuff like self-liquidation bots that would help us be able to either, it's a case in which we'd like to, you know, exit the position as quickly as possible. If everybody else's positions go down with us, then we get to at least like...
Something I really wanted to do now that I actually have expertise, because I got in before 2021 DeFi summer happened. Like when Sushi dropped for the first time, Sushi and Pickle, that's when I got in. And man, I super wish I built yield farming bots for that time, because that was just insane. Food coin, it was like you're in a supermarket, but like...
Supermarket.
Yeah, supermarket where like there's just money instead of food. Crazy. Like yield farming was the shit. Like you will have 10k APY on anything minimum. And this is actually a strategy I was thinking of recently, but you know how you have like LP sniping? I haven't implemented this, but it's a cool idea. In that time, it would have been good, but it's like LP sniping where you automatically buy the token somehow. You pair it into the LP that are in the farms and you snipe it with the smallest amount you can do, like one way worth of the LP token. It basically does it where you're the only one in the pool, so you have 100% ownership of one way of the token. And so you'll just farm it, because people don't update the website simultaneously when it's released. I've personally done that. It's like a bit delayed, so you could like theoretically snipe it all for a bit and just make stupid gains in it. But that was just like an idea I thought. Hopefully there's another yield farming craze. I don't know what the next one will be. What do you think will be the next craze?
Never know. I think that going towards the lines of what you're mentioning in terms of just-in-time liquidity, and I think a lot of people are sort of realizing that, of course, LPing nowadays onto certain types of different protocols has its flaws, especially when it comes to seconds. You know, of course, there's like now these different metrics that are being explored, such as LVR by Tim Roughgarden, of course, Flare by the Uniswap team, where they're pretty much comparing it to, let's say, trade on a centralized exchange and seeing how exactly the block time sort of affects your positions. I think we're definitely sort of seeing a shift towards more of a focus on active strategies, where there is a focus on that sort of precision when it comes to perhaps where you land on a block. such that you can execute these different opportunities, such as just-in-time liquidity provisioning, or even the sandwiching now has been quite hit, of course, with Jared.
He's doing JIT as well now.
Yeah. And then being able to sort of democratize that opportunity in certain ways might be quite interesting. I think we're sort of seeing that now, especially when it comes to these different solver systems, especially when it comes to different intent systems like Anoma, Suave. I think we're definitely seeing a lot of these different solver systems coming up where they are taking this sort of off-chain execution, but using on-chain liquidity. So this would be from a user's wallet and essentially allowing them in order to be able to provide a sort of best price to the user in order to be able to trade. So of course, these different intent systems are popping out, these different intents that users sign for, where they say, oh, I'm willing to take this price and nothing more. A good example could be like CowSwap. There's, of course, some interesting different systems coming up. Good example is Uniswap X, where they are using a concept known as the Dutch limit order in order to reduce the price of a limit order over time, such that users are able to get some sort of eventuality when it comes to their order being fulfilled.
You know, I was thinking about this. I think the intent and the account abstraction scene is going to be the next wave, plus whatever new liquidity solutions there are coming out. I've spoken to a lot of people about this, and it's pretty obvious that LPing is just so useless. I mean, you have JIT, which basically eradicates all the fees, and you're taking on all the risk. You're basically exit liquidity if you're providing liquidity. And the yield don't even make sense anymore that it's worth it. So there needs to be some kind of new liquidity incentive.
Exactly. I think when it comes to things like, let's say, even like, you know, good example is account abstraction, that we can see that it's sort of tending towards this sort of non-custodial solution where I can work off the funds that are still inside of my account, inside my own wallets, and be able to essentially be able to price it how I want off-chain and be able to get that sort of confirmation that it will be fulfilled at some time. With that, it's the case in which push now when you have these sort of different systems where essentially they are able to work towards how users are working, as opposed to users having to deposit inside of smart contracts, that of course everybody's funds get put together and of course no one knows if there's going to be exploits and whatnot unless they're
inherent.
So I think a lot of these systems are really, really quite nice that they're allowing for this sort of exploration where they're moving towards this sort of innovation where it upholds the non-custodial nature that users want, alongside being able to also offer them potentially good prices when it comes to liquidity provisioning. A good example is CowSwap, where I think they're doing a really, really good job into essentially researching frequent batch auctions. Another one, in fact, is also Sorella as well. So Sorella is a really, really cool team, and I think they have a really cool, interesting solution with Hamstrung.
Yeah, I think I have Ludwig. I have an intro with him soon. We'll see how that goes. I think my friend Fiddly G just joined them. So I've heard good things. I think they're backed by a few people, big players, which is kind of a meme now. But
yeah, they're backed by a couple of good people. But yeah, no, so, where I sort of find myself in my journey now, especially like within like the last couple of years, has mostly been, yeah, essentially doing more short tail strategies. I guess it's sort of inevitable since, of course, the long tail of the past is now sort of short tail of now, you know, especially DexDex, even SexDex now, and liquidations. There's a lot of capacity there. There's a lot of opportunities there. And I think everybody is trying to go for them.
I think long tail is going to get commercialized by automated cyber tooling, like fuzzers and AI fuzzers, for example. Because they'll, if they're finding exploits, an exploit is just like an MEV strategy. I guess you can argue when it becomes a hack to, I guess, a dollar point.
Yeah.
It's kind of when people, like what I found, it's a bloodline. Yeah,
like
but
what I found, when it, especially when it comes to a previous history of working with different searching teams, as well as even building some searching teams as well for firms and whatnot, is that very much a lot of the overhead is not, in fact, let's say, you know, strategy generation, being able to find, let's say, these sort of long tail strategies, but rather more actually the integration into them. It's quite nice that, of course, with smart contracts on chain, that you have this universal interface that you can tap into. Whether that be, let's say, ERC-20s or V2, V3 pools, where a lot of people are sort of following that standard nowadays. It's quite nice that you're able to easily plug into the systems, and that if a protocol adheres essentially to them, that the integration is very easy as simply just adding in the factory address and being able to skim through all the pools and so on. And so integration is a lot of these long-tail opportunities. Really, I think that it is actually quite easy to find them when you essentially do find them, and you sort of go into that mindset that, you know, you want to find these opportunities and that you're able to spot them. A good example is going into a crypto game, like a good example is Crabada, and being able to see the sort of economics and sort of microstructure there and how exactly that works to potentially be able to either programmatically things there, but most of the actual interface when it comes to, of course, like these sort of long tail opportunities sometimes can be quite difficult in order to integrate. So I think really I definitely would agree that as these different generalized systems that come about that either try to, let's say, democratize integrations into these different long tail projects or even them through fuzzers, it's potentially likely that we'll see long tail, as Yuma said, essentially be commercialized.
Yeah, because the cyber people will just create some AI fuzzer. They'll find all these strategies. Some of them won't be hacks. It will just be a game design that the developer made. And then they would sell these strategies to MEV teams because they wouldn't do it themselves. They're just automated, you know, security firms, right? So it's this, unless they spin up their own HFT, but then they have to build this infrastructure and a team, and they wouldn't do that. At least I wouldn't do that if I was doing it. So then it would be this kind of a sales opportunity, which is what I realized when I was building mine. I actually know some people, some searching teams getting into building a fuzzer to find long tails.
It's not that for, of course, like, you know, let's say block builders where, you know, it's nice enough to get a few more transactions in from, you know, long tail opportunities or whatnot.
Yeah. I think the integration part is fun. It depends on who you kind of are. If you're like just really optimizing a single thing or continuously changing, finding new things all the time, which is what I like, then it's a very exhilarating field. But the only way to do it really is just to know a protocol in depth or to automate it somehow. And when you go down the automation route, you're getting into basically fuzzing and cyber at that point. So, I mean, it's a good thing, but maybe, I don't know.
Pretty much when it came to working with like some of these C5 TradFi firms, pretty much integrating into these different centralized exchanges, these different venues that you wanted to trade on, very much it's a case in which you would have to sort of stick to this sort of schema. You'd have to try to go through hell and back in order to integrate into this very esoteric when it came to integrating into them. And there wouldn't be really any sort of upside to them. You'd essentially be, there's a term that we like to use called essentially being the integration bitch, it was the case in which we needed to integrate into a, let's say, a new exchange or whatnot. Then you would, of course, you know, all the turmoil of that sometimes is that, you know, it could be like weeks or so that essentially that task, it would almost become like a project, that task and, you know, the pains of essentially working with the representative from the exchange, it would be so odd. No, it's pretty cool that, especially when it comes to integrating into these different DeFi venues, these centralized exchanges, aside from centralized exchanges, these different DeFi venues on chain, it's pretty cool being able to see, of course, their, you know, their systems and how they sort of work, and being able to potentially find opportunities in that.
Yeah, actually, there was one time where I was doing a long tail bot, and I was integrating into it because we found a long tail opportunity. And as I was doing it, I was reading the contract and I noticed that it was a long tail arbitrage. And I realized that you could go forward from like token A, exchange rate, Uniswap. But then I realized you could go backwards. And it was also like the backwards because the long tail contract enabled you to reverse the wrapping. So you could wrap the token, then unwrap it. But the current people that were running the long tail didn't know that you could unwrap it. And when I figured that out, it was actually 3 times more valuable, the unwrapper part, than the wrapping part. And that was like, that boosted, they eventually found out, but they originally found out and it was making like 50K a month before the unwrapping. And then when they found the reverse strategy, it was like 200K a month. And it was like, whoa. What's happening? Exactly.
Forget that. So when it comes to like, let's say staking on staking, that technically in itself is technically a liquidity pool, you know, an infinite liquidity pool.
Yeah, exactly. The staking, unstaking, wrapping, unwrapping, any kind of exchange rate-esque thing is, you can treat it like a Uniswap pool, for example, and you can kind of combine it with other stuff. I love the long tail strategies. They're so cool. I think they're way more interesting and fun to mess around with than short tail. Short tail is just like a game.
Very much it gets optimized to a point where, you know, now you have to think about co-locating.
Yeah, so lame. I want to use my creativity
to like offers, like, you know, some of these different node providers, like such as Boxrun, Chainpound, and having to figure out that 1 to 100.
You basically just need money to like scale and get an exclusive backdoor deal. I mean, that's basically the monopoly it is now. If you want to do any kind of MEV at a grand scale, I think the long tail stuff is a lot more fun.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's not easy to do.
And it's a matter of case of essentially whether anyone is willing to put in that sort of hard work in order to actually understand that sort of small microstructure for that long tail opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's, if I were to get into MEV today, I would do long tail and then make articles when they die. Because then, because it's the best way of promoting it. It just shows you have creativity. You can go down into the contract and scrutinize it and then find the game theory within it. When obviously, if it's a big protocol, then that's a giant edge. If people are already looking at it and auditing it and you're the one that found it, well, then it's just kind of a cool story as well that nobody's told.
Yeah, no, that was like pretty fun when my friends essentially did that. And it's always just fun seeing like sort of, let's say, nuances that essentially they would talk about in these different articles and just seeing how people that were completely outside of the MEV space essentially would react to it, especially when it came to these different nuances and whatnot that would almost, in a sense, sort of kill these protocols at times. It was always interesting to see. I think a good example, of course, recently was Olympus, like the sort of rebase arbitrage opportunity that you could sort of do. So that was with any sort of fork that you could do, so Ample Fourth included, where very much it would be the case in which would they be able to... Yeah, so it would be the case in which you'd be able to essentially trigger the rebase. Yeah, and you'd be able to essentially, because of the fact that, of course, they didn't want to do it themselves, either via like a keeper system, keep DAO or Gelato now. Pretty much it was the case in which they allowed for anyone to do it. And very much then you could arbitrage from that by just batching multiple contract calls of stake your own or your that rebase token, and it'll just then dump back into the market.
Yeah, the one with Ample I found was, so as a rebasing every 24 hours, but to, in order for it to rebase, you have to trigger it by clicking the rebase button. But you could do a giant flash loan of getting all the Ample you possibly could. Then you trigger rebase. So now you rebased all that flash loan Ample. And then you repay the Ample you borrowed. But since you rebased positively, you now gain Ample for free. So you just use like millions of dollars of Ample, rebased it, let's say 5%, paid back the $1 million, now you have 5% of a million.
It's quite crazy just to see these long tail opportunities are always fun, just like experience, especially when it came to picking up Uni V3. In fact, there's like certain nuances that I picked up, especially when it came to helping some of these different firms for like as well sex tech strategies. Like good example is the fact that flash loan fees, if you decide to flash loan a whole V3 pool, it's very much a case in which even though everybody has offered their liquidity, it's only the people within inside of the range that essentially earn the flash loan fees. So people even out of the money when it comes to active range inside of V3 pool wouldn't earn that 0.3% in the flash loan fee, and rather more so be only people that would essentially be inside of the active range that would get it. So yeah, there's always interesting nuances, different protocols. What if like people always ask me, you know, to, of course, you know, how do I get started with MEV? I always like tell them, of course, for one, build up this sort of habit of looking at different smart contracts and sort of understanding their sort of microstructure to them and understanding the nuances or flaws that you could essentially pick out such that it's much more favorable for you and that could potentially be a trading strategy.
Yeah, we love our long tail kings. Yeah. Don't get into it though. I want my long tail. It's all mine.
I think a lot of these systems nowadays, especially when it comes to OFAs, are pretty much helping to, in a sense, bring about greater awareness of these different long-tail opportunities, which is why I also agree with the sentiment that these different ARB opportunities included very much are going to be commercialized, not exactly via OFAs, but rather more so through these different intent sort of systems.
Wait, order flow auctions are public, right? Is this what you're saying?
Technically, it's a case in which there's quite a few OFAs which have a whitelist system in order to, for one, minimize the sort of rate limit, but also try to minimize the potential in order to potentially front run or sandwich in user's bundle before it gets sent. So there's a couple of systems where it's whitelisted. There's others such as MevBlocker and MevShare where it's luckily quite open for anyone to plug in. Luckily, the team dedicated to those have the capacity in order to be able to analyze these different scenarios that can happen. A good example, I'm Robert Miller from Flash Wall Street, a really, really good deep dive, in fact, on some of these different situations. And so it's always interesting just to see like where information is being leaked. But I think ultimately, it sort of leads these different OFAs, the different solver systems that are coming into place, are all, of course, converging towards this goal. Of course, internalizing MEV such that the user essentially gets a better rebate or gets better prices.
Yeah, because the big challenge with a long tail is you only do it for a little bit because like people just look at Block Explorer and see... Well, they would just go through each transaction because I've done this personally of every block, and you'll come across like these bots, like, you know, the addresses that are using function selectors and it doesn't actually have a function name because it's not verified. And so you would click on these and you would go through each of them and you'll find that these are the bots, right? Maybe they're tagged with MEV bot, maybe they're not. You click on them and you go through their transaction. You can actually reverse engineer their long tail strategy, and that's how they're taken away, because the big players do this and then they just steal it and use their infrastructure to outcompete you.
Yeah.
And then you have to go find another one that's just being yoinked from you. It's like the bully taking your lunch money. You can't do shit.
I guess luckily it's a case in which there are these different systems that are coming up in terms of helping to essentially democratize or decentralize some of these systems, these different interesting concepts that are helping in order to like try to get back into this sort of situation of meritocracy first as opposed to being monopolistic system.
Yeah, we don't like monopolies. Unless we're the monopoly.
Yeah, even long-term opportunities, I think that they'll have their own sort of solutions to them. I think there was one really, really solution that I've seen quite some time ago, in fact, for NFT mints, where what they would do is that they have this off-chain auction system where people could place bids through the dApp, but they would place these, users would essentially place these bids for this NFT mint. And pretty much this mempool system, it's called a Pika Pool. I know that the branding had like Ash Ketchum with Pikachu as well in it. And so very much what they would do is this, you know, off-chain sort of system, almost like reminiscent, of course, of like a MevShare or like what Flashmas is doing. Pretty much what they would do is take all these different signed mints, essentially. So these wouldn't be submitted on-chain just yet, but they would take these different intents in order to essentially mint, calculate some sort of best price, and us then distribute, take all of these different signed mints, as well as ether that they would get from them, or ether or tokens or whatnot, pull it together, and then in one transaction, which is when essentially that auction ends, pretty much serve all of the NFTs to users, as well as return any sort of excess or whatnot. I think that with the NFT sort of craze that has happened in like the past couple of years or whatnot, we sort of seen like similar systems now, you know, come to trial that, of course, pretty much what the ICO was back in the days were sort of doing. But I don't think it's been really, really explored. So I think for, especially these sort of long-term opportunities where they can be more categorized, such as, let's say, NFT, MEV, basis trades or whatnot, that they eventually will find their solutions that help to the sort of theme that has been going on, in a sense, commercialize them. That very reminiscent to potentially like the sort of generalized systems that we see, such as MevShare or Anomos and Suave.
Interesting. Yeah. You did mention you built these MEV teams in the past, multiple. So you would know best of how to get into this stuff. Well, you already mentioned how to get into it. But I guess when you find a strategy, run me down how you would quickly iterate, get it out into prod and get to the next big thing. I think a lot of people don't really do it properly or have tried and failed. How do you move fast? Because these opportunities are out in the public permanently, and it's just a matter of time until someone grabs them. It could be you, could be someone else, and you could be developing it, but then someone else takes it and you're like, fuck.
Yeah, I think especially when it comes to like finding these different opportunities, I generally have a really, really set routine when it comes to them, particularly with the long tail stuff, where it results around essentially getting a base MVP implementation out first. So being able to create this sort of system, create the off-chain code plus potentially the smart contract in order to interact with any sort of smart contract presence on-chain and simulate this sort of strategy, set up the scenario for it, and then also then test out just to see, test out off-chain inside the simulation, whether it, of course, capitalizes on opportunities or not. In, of course, let's say, in Atomic's opportunities and whatnot, it's very, very easy to simulate with a lot of tooling out there now. Of course, with more multi-transaction opportunities, there requires a bit more fitness.
I think probably the most interesting, the multi-transaction non-atomic. Just imagine everyone is doing Atomic and nobody is really doing non-atomic. The sentiment for it is like cross-chain, whatever strategies for non-atomic, but maybe there is a multi-transaction that is in the same chain and people just don't explore that. Or maybe they do and they just don't take the risk. It's a lot more TradFi risk management.
There's one part to it where it's very much started to touch along the lines of providing or having some sort of liquidity up front such that you can take on this opportunity and then also trade it. It's very much along the lines of high frequency trading where you're very much have this sort of capital and that you're able to get in, exploit the opportunity and then get out soon afterwards. And so I think that's one of the things that I think has stopped a lot of innovation that's happened there is just the sort of risk that happens there. Of course, when it comes to Atomic strategies, that it's very, very easy to flash loan, easy to simulate that and try it out without any sort of capital that you can do it for your own bedroom. But when it comes to multi-transaction, non-atomic strategies, very much, of course, capital has always been an issue, essentially. There's, of course, multi-transaction flash loans have been, of course, a concept that has been spoken about, but rather more so that there are always risks to it that essentially fall back on some issues when it comes to the more stuff on chain.
The multi-transaction flash loans, I wonder how much benefit that would have over just traditional single block trend flash loans. I was thinking of this actually today. If I had to develop this, how would I do this? I would do the flash loan. Your protocol would only allow Uniswap, for example, but then there's the attack vulnerability of them creating their own pool and then flash loaning that.
Yeah, but then also it's case in which it makes just-in-time liquidity easier, but also makes sandwiching easier. So,
oh, yeah.
So it's almost this sort of accelerationist system in order to essentially say, hey, you know, if sandwiching is pretty much easy to do, then we build systems in order to prevent, of course, sandwiching from happening or essentially these different multi-transaction opportunities from being exploited and messing with users. It's definitely pretty cool, you know, having done my time. It's very much a case in which I can sort of look towards more so the product side of things. So it's definitely the case in which with like these different MEV bots or different strategies, what I think that it's more so a focus on 0-to-1 implementation, getting a base implementation out. Over time, you'll sort of create these different systems, you build these different tools yourself that would essentially help with making this process a lot more easier, where you're able to potentially out a bot in potentially even less than an hour. I know that, of course, like some people literally that come to me and like say that they spend multiple days even on a strategy. And sometimes that's the case in which it doesn't really cut it. Go from, let's say, you know, being able to spot an opportunity to then essentially implementing a bot for it that essentially exploits it as soon as possible. It is very, very key. And I think that it sort of helps a lot with once you get that base implementation, you can then luckily iterate on it and apply these other optimizations that you want to make, potentially put in your own specialized smart contract for it. If you're using a very generalized smart contract like Wavero or even your own, it sort of follows this pattern of 0-to-1, try out the strategy, make sure that that it's actually doing something before then actually spending the time to like really, really optimize it.
Yeah. I think the best advice I would give is look at raw API calls to nodes. Because you can simulate stuff with that instead of just using something like Ether's RS. You can just use it directly and send transactions directly. And you don't need latency if you're doing long tail. You can just use flashbots like private mempool and then you're safe, right? And I think the big thing is building a template. I actually did this, selfless plug, but on my GitHub, github.com/Debati. It's an MEV template that you can just plug and play. And you just create a contract, plug it into every block, mempool, whatever, just use an API or something. And then you just plug in a contract, and it shouldn't be that hard to, it should take a couple hours, unless you don't know how to code smart contracts. That's the only issue. But then you have to do some DevOps. You just run on a server or just on your laptop. Shouldn't take that hard, but that's really it.
Even then, it's like some people, I think, overcomplicate it. Almost like a startup in a sense. Like, I know that some people that I've spoken to that literally will try to over-optimize things even before they launch their
startup. That's a big thing. Even in startup, just in general programming, I actually fell victim to this as well, but it's way better to get something out that's really poorly written and is very shitty in terms of optimization, but at least it works. You're already ahead of the guy that's trying to optimize it for like the lowest millisecond, the best, very clean code, and they haven't even got the product out. It's always better to treat projects as the final quarter, 1 minute to go, instead of a marathon, because you just keep iterating. That's how you get to places faster, empirically, rather than theorizing or fantasizing about the result, because then you'll never get out the door, and there's never a dopamine hit to continue, and it's like you're doing all the work, you're not getting any results, you may feel like decent for a little bit, but then you don't see any results, and then you feel shitty, and then you never do it again. Whereas the guy that hits the ground running, even though it's shitty, he sees something, and now there's a motivation to iterate on it. And that's how they get to the highest points. And that's like every startup.
Yeah, some of the solvers that I've met from CowSwap ecosystem, they tell me a lot of the different integrations that we're making, in fact, for CowSwap solving was, in fact, just Dex aggregators, where they would use either, like, let's say, you know, take the core data that they would get from Dex aggregators, and they could just use that essentially do all their sort of path solving for essentially different solutions or whatnot. And they would just batch a bunch of those and then also then be able to use that as a means of essentially solving this castle batch. And so that sticked around apparently for like quite some time. And it sort of shows that you don't need the most optimized contract in order to win, that very much once you're able to get a very, very easy solution out there that is, for one, very early to an opportunity, as well as able to essentially capitalize on it, the sort of revenue that you're able to make from it alongside the span of that sort of opportunity without sort of any additional optimizations or whatnot, tends to be more than if over optimized solution comes along later. It tends to be a case in which rather the early bird gets the worm.
Yeah, it's always do something shitty, and all you need to do is read Solidity. But even some contracts aren't even verified on Etherscan, so you just have bytecode, and then maybe they open source on GitHub, so it's like, but maybe they update the source code on Etherscan, so then it's like discrepancies. But I think the best thing to do is being able to read Solidity. This is the bare minimum. Read Solidity. Think a little bit creatively, and you get that from reading multiple contracts or multiple protocols, and you think of these things in some game theory way, combinatronic, I think that's what it's saying, combinations of things, maybe permutations as well, in different orders of these combinations. That's it. And then you just find something that seems interesting and doesn't seem normal. And if you want to scale that, well, all you really need to do is learn the call opcode, to be honest. Call opcode, static call opcode, that's all you need. And you can kind of attack everything, and everything just falls under that. But it's really just creativity. But that just stems from learning a lot of contracts to begin with. So then you just look at them differently. And maybe even looking past long tail stories as well.
Yeah. Like a lot of the past long tail stories, pretty much, of course, they often don't show the code. But having like seen some of these examples that they've used, pretty much it's a case in which it's some of the most hackiest code that you would ever see.
Do I wonder if people we'll use ChatGPT, like throw in a code base, like two code bases, and be like, can I interact with these two together in any way?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that if you are able to take an instance of it and specialize it, train it on
ChatGPT MEV. MEV GPT. Be on the lookout. That's my next project. People and taking investors. MEV GPT. Man, it's been great chatting about long tail strategies. I hope people don't come in and steal mine. It's all worth it for the content, for the memes. And it's been great having you on. Have you done one in the past?
Not really, no.
So,
Yeah, I've done a couple of talks here and there.
From the first podcast, guys. Let's go. I took them from everyone. But man, pleasure having you on. I'm sure we're gonna have more chats. I'm gonna see you in London soon. More memes will be had, and hopefully I'll do another podcast down the road and have some more memes to share. So man, thank you so much, Taker, for jumping on. I'll see you on the chain, on the block.
Yeah, see you guys in the mempool.
You in the mempool, guys. Don't drown.
When it comes to non-EVM, I'll be there.
Take care, everyone. See you on the block.
See you guys.